Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Dave Perry. On today's show, which we're recording July 22nd, 2021, we're talking about the United States' implementation of the Women, Peace, and Security Agenda with Stephanie Foster and Susan Markham of Smash Strategies and Dr. Carolyn Washington from Florida State University. This episode is part of a series on American security challenges funded by the United States Department of State. Please note that the opinions, findings, and conclusions stated herein are those of the guest speakers and moderator only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the United States Department of State. For 111 years, the Royal Canadian Navy has worked closely with our allies around the world. During the Battle of the Atlantic, Canada's Navy stood shoulder to shoulder with our allies. Many of the ships that Canada put to sea in World War II were built in Canada, and that tradition lives on today. Our sponsor, Irving Shipbuilding, will build the new Canadian Surface Combatant for Canada at the Halifax Shipyard. The CSC is based on the Type 26 Global Combat Ship design, which is currently under construction in the United Kingdom and Australia. Canada's CSC will also be equipped with the Aegis Combat System, extending Canada's interoperability with six allied nations around the world. The new CSC will be Canada's most advanced ship ever built and is the superior choice to protect and support Canadian sailors. The Royal Canadian Navy has always stood up for Canada's interests and stood with our allies to secure them. The CSC ensures our Navy has the tools it needs to take that legacy into the future. Susan, Stephanie, Carolyn, thank you all for joining us today. And so we'll dive right into this. And Susan, I'm gonna come to you first. Can you kick off the conversation by setting the stage a little bit for us and give us some of the background that happened in your country that led to the passing of the WPS Act? What led to the bill? How much support did it have on which sides of the aisle? And give us a little sense of color on how you got to where you are now.
Great. Thank you so much. Good morning, everyone. 10 years ago, obviously, there was the 10th anniversary of UN Security Council resolution. And at the time, we had President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. So during this time, there was a lot of discussion about women, peace, and security agenda and how the United States could better implement it. So first, there was a US civil society working group on women, peace, and security formed around 2009, 2010. They were very focused on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, but also were advocating for a US national action plan. We had not had one in the first 10 years. So the US issued its first national action plan on women, peace, and security in 2011. And then it was updated in 2016, 5 years later. So there was all this movement and we felt it was positive and moving towards implementing through the US government. After Donald Trump's election, there was a brief pause, and actually Stephanie and I went and spoke to the civil society working group, brainstorming, okay, where do we go from here? Just because foreign policy had not been widely discussed by Donald Trump during the campaign, and we weren't sure where this agenda would go. But largely, the civil society working group really pivoted towards the Hill and to the agencies after the 2016 election, because there was still bipartisan support for the issues and for the National Action Plan. And so a group, everything from civil society organizations to this coalition of groups really pushed high on the Hill, and they wanted it to be bipartisan. And so worked throughout the year. There was already draft language, but they were up on the Hill and bringing in, you know, people from the Defense Department, because we felt that those were often some of the most unlikely supporters of this, right? They're going to think civil societies for it. But when you have members of the Defense Department coming up saying, yes, this is important for us too, that really helped it be a bipartisan bill. And as you said, it was the first national action plan that is now law around the world. So I think it's a good bill. I think a lot of people think of it as a good start. A couple things that we would love to do better is that it's global. It's very outward facing. While we do training for women, peace, and security for our staff across defense, diplomacy, and development, it's really what we're doing in other countries as opposed to our own. And it's really focused on representation. So they want to count the number of women in the room at various points around women, peace, and security. But, you know, obviously, those of us who work on gender equality want more. But it was a good first step, and the fact that it was bipartisan kept the conversation going. And then during the Trump years, they did put out a strategy, And then agencies had to put out an implementation plan. And then just in the last month, the Biden administration has put out a report on what's happened in the 5 years since the, almost 5 years since the WPS Act has been implemented. So we still move along across different administrations to implement the Women, Peace, and Security Act here.
Okay, thanks. So I'm going to draw out a little bit what you were just saying there about the implementation and touching on the different agencies. And Stephanie, I'll come to you first on this, but can you talk a little bit about how the agenda has been framed as a whole of government approach in the United States? What's making it whole of government, and how do the different agencies, the different departments, the different constituent parts of the United States government come together around this particular agenda? And what's the role of the ambassador at large here?
A couple of things, really, I want to reiterate that Susan said, because I think they help frame the conversation and this question about whole of government. The Act is very clear that it is focused on our overseas engagements. That's how we are have framed the Act. And I think it's also, of course, one of the places where a lot of people really feel that we need to branch out and to really look internally more across all of our work in the government. Domestic and international, to really look at how we can ensure that we are using these same precepts in our own policymaking relative to the United States. But in terms of a whole of government approach, what we've seen across the four main agencies, the Department of State, USAID, the Department of Defense, and now the Department of Homeland Security, is really working in somewhat parallel silos, sometimes more coordinated than others, to really look at these various ways that the work gets done and can interact. I think one of the lessons that we've learned is that when we employ, you know, this whole of government approach and the tools that we have from all the various parts of our government, we can be more effective. And we've seen that in terms of evaluations of actual programs and policies that have been put into place. So when we can marshal our public diplomacy, our bilateral and multilateral diplomacy, our foreign assistance, and our other tools of US government assistance, we can really make a difference. I think we've done less of that maybe than we say we have, just because it's hard to keep this all going. And you see that there are many different aspects of it. But I do think the reason it's a really good goal and the way that we have to move forward is that it is indeed true that when these agencies and entities are working in concert, we're much more able to see better outcomes in the countries in which we're working. And of course, that's one of the biggest goals here, is to ensure that women are part of decision-making abroad, are part of the assistance we give to the security sector, that women are engaged in fighting violent extremism and counterterrorism efforts. So it's really looking at those various aspects and entities and what they all bring to the table. In terms of the role of the Department of State and the Ambassador at Large for Global Women's Issues, I mean, that person is reflective of, you know, representing the body within the US government that sets that policy, what is our policy in terms of women, peace, and security, and really is an advocate globally for that policy, whether it's advocating in the case of during the Trump administration. Ambassador Curry really spent a lot of time advocating around issues around Afghanistan and how to encourage the participation of more women in the Afghan peace talks. She also worked a lot on issues around the Rohingya. She worked a lot on issues around Yemen and trying to ensure that there was more women's participation in transition efforts being conducted around Yemen. So I think we've seen, even in an administration that many would say was not as friendly to women, peace, and security, a really strong sense that the ambassador herself could make a difference in terms of policy formulation and advocacy around the world. And I would say we expect that, especially as there's now a White House Gender Policy Council that focuses both on international and domestic issues, that we'll see more of a focus on these issues more broadly.
Carolyn, I'll just ask you to add to that from a defense point of view. Stephanie used the phrase sometimes parallel silos there, and that made me think of the way the armed services sometimes appear to be aligned or not on different issues. But from a defense point of view, how does that cross-government, cross-agency, cross-service perspective play out?
Stephanie mentioned coordination among the three Ds, a diplomacy, development and defense, in addition, Department of Homeland Security. And also, it was mentioned that there's a civil society working group. So when you talk about coordination and coalition, the civil society working group plays an important role in doing that. Also, and they've also reached out to Department of Defense as well as the other implementing agencies. And most recently, let me back up for a few minutes. The Civil Society Working Group, or CSWG, is a nonpartisan network of about 50 civil society organizations that have expertise on the impacts of conflict on women and their participation in peace building. And it was established in 2010 to support the effective implementation of Women, Peace, and Security Act of 2017. Most recently, in March of this year, the CSWG had a session with the Department of Defense, basically major combatant commands, regional combatant commands like Southern Command, Northern Command, or NORTHCOM, and a few others. And what these DOD officials did is they gave an update to the CSWG on some of their key initiatives, both internally and how they're organized and how they have their gender advisors or their GENADs actually implement the program with of Women, Peace, and Security within their organizations, and also some of their partnerships with the regional organizations within their area. Say, for instance, SOUTHCOM, the areas that they deal with there, NORTHCOM in this particular hemisphere. And so some of the participation, some of the coordination that the Department of Defense is doing with within the government, in particular in this instance, the civil society working group.
Okay, thank you. Susan, I don't know if you have anything you wanted to add on that, the whole of government aspect particularly, but I'd also ask you to talk a little bit about how the United States approaches this agenda in internationally engaging, balancing between bilateral engagements, or what's part of a wider multilateral kind of perspective. So where's the weight of emphasis between those two approaches? And then the other component of that would be, what does the passage of the WPS Act signal about how the United States is looking at positioning itself internationally with respect to this agenda?
So just to go back to the responses from the others, I previously spoke about this with the former ambassador for global women's issues, Kathy Russell, during the Obama administration. And because it was kind of muddy about who did what. So the way I thought about it was the Department of State, their role was to advocate for more women's participation in peace processes. And they can go to NATO and the G7 and to these countries one-on-one and say, look, as we move ahead, we're going to bring more women to the peace process. You need to have women represented as well by civil society or other groups. The role of the Defense Department is when they're going in and playing a role that the Defense Department does with the military, they are reaching beyond the usual actors to hear from women's organizations and other groups about what security means to them. Because as Don Steinberg used to say, right, it used to be men with guns talking to other men with guns about men and guns, which is not true security or peace for a lot of people around the world. So the Defense Department broadens who they're talking to about what security means. The USAID, our job is to make sure we're working with women on the ground through civil society, training them to be these peace mediators. How do you represent the women of your country so that when the State Department makes a seat for you there, how can you go there and the women are ready to go? As well as working with the women who've been involved in the peace process to move to the more formal political system, hopefully democracy, but how do you move from to be a peacemaker to a member of parliament and that sort of thing? And then the Department of Homeland Security are thinking about the issues that they deal with, whether it's immigration or natural disasters, what are the gender angles of this, right? It's not just providing places where people can go when there's a hurricane, but are women's needs being kept? Are women and children, do they feel safe? Do they have a place to go that's maybe separate from men? So all of these groups work together. We obviously overlap, but we're aware of the lane that we're working in and how it complements the work of the other agencies and departments as well. So I know that was long, but I think it's important to think about the unique place we can each play, but how we can also support the role of other agencies and departments. So under the previous administration, with the Trump administration, you know, it really focused on women's economic empowerment. So although the Women, Peace, and Security Act was passed and signed by President Trump, their initial strategy came out late, the implementation plans came out late, there was some money, but it was a lot more rhetoric than actual movement forward. At USAID, the focus of the administrator at the time, Mark Green, was really on self-reliance. And so I think sometimes it was hard to say, well, if we're dealing with peace and security issues, whether it's a man-made disaster or a natural disaster, you know, what does self-reliance have to do with that? USAID, we go in and we do the humanitarian assistance regardless of self-reliance at the initial time. And so now it's moving much more back to, you know, the more integrated work of participation, protection, building internal capabilities so that governments and organizations can take on these roles. I'm not sure if I answered your second question, but that's how, you know, people are thinking about it the same and differently during the Trump administration.
No, that's great. And I'm going to ask, Stephanie, can you build on that and give a bit of a sense about, so as the United States is looking at advancing this agenda internationally, what's the balance between a bilateral approach, a regional approach, a wider multilateral approach, and where is the weight of effort placed? Where does the focus get put?
Well, again, I think it's important to think about the fact that we have the ability, you know, as a global player to really bring to bear all of those all of the tools that we have, as Susan said, and as Carolyn has said, in terms of bringing those to bear on the issues. I think, you know, and I know Canada has been very prominent in the multilateral space in women, peace, and security, and has played a really, I think, leadership and outsized role. I think for the U.S., as we kind of move into the Biden administration and a return to more of a global, you know, sort of multilateral approach, which certainly President Biden and Secretary Blinken have spoken about, and Administrator Power. I think we see that we're gonna be sorting out, I think, how much do we focus on bilateral engagement, multilateral and regional engagement. Obviously, I think one thing, and I went back and looked at the report that was just done by the various departments, the four departments put out by the Biden administration about a month ago. And a lot of it is looking at what we have done bilaterally in terms of the four pillars of women, peace, and security as they've slightly been reconstituted in the US to be participation, prevention, internal US capacity building, and partnerships. And a lot of that really is looking at bilateral engagement, what we've been able to do at the embassy and USAID mission level to engage with women, whether, again, it's in security sector reform or public leadership. But I think, interestingly, you know, we've also seen in the reporting and in the focus moving forward, the importance of the multilateral space, as well as the importance of how the U.S. engages with civil society and with leaders who are on the ground and aren't always the usual suspects. And we say this a lot and have always said this, that, you know, you learn a lot, obviously, from talking to people on the ground who are actually living the reality every day. So I think in addition to looking at bilateral and multilateral engagement, a focus is, and I think will continue to be, how to engage with civil society, both in the US, obviously we have the civil society working group, but really also at the field and mission level, because I think that also brings in perspectives that we just don't get otherwise. And one of the focus areas for the US government, I think, is really pushing people on the at the level of, again, the mission and the embassy level to go out and make sure that they're engaging with civil society leaders and women leaders across those countries. And I served in Afghanistan at the embassy, and I know that was actually my job, was to do that. And I think I was able to bring in, you know, other pieces of information and nuanced kind of analysis to the decision makers that then they could use as they were formulating their policies. So I think it's a multifaceted approach. The good news about the US, I think, is that we have the ability to be players in, you know, all of those spheres, whether it's, again, bilateral engagement or multilateral engagement, whether it's the UN or G7, G20, NATO, ASEAN, all the various places around the world where we can play a role.
Now let's take a quick break to hear about one of our sponsors. In the next few months, Canada will select its next fighter aircraft that will help ensure the safety and security of Canadians and deliver economic benefits to industry. The next generation Block 3 Super Hornet is the best choice to take on Canada's most complex missions. It will also deliver more than 250,000 high-paying jobs and $61 billion to Canada's economy over the life of the program. This is nearly three times more than its competitors. It has also work that stays in Canada, guaranteed. Along with the economic benefits, the Super Hornet is the most efficient, affordable means of transitioning from Canada's existing CF-18s to a new platform. It is capable of performing the full range of tactical strike fighter missions required by the Royal Canadian Air Force at a much more affordable rate. For the Canadian men and women in uniform that will be flying this aircraft, it's important that they can execute their mission safely and return home each and every day. The Block 3 Super Hornet's two-engine design ensures safe operations over open sea, the Arctic, and other challenging environments. Whether it's today or tomorrow, Boeing will continue to be a partner to Canada well into the future.
To switch the focus a little bit, Carolyn, I'll ask you to talk a little bit about what's happening inside the U.S. government and how the agenda is playing out. So I guess, what have the efforts looked like to get a better representation within the personnel of the different aspects of the U.S. government and DOD in particular? How does that jive with the external focused aspects of the WPS Act? And have you seen some evidence of improving in those aspects of participation that the Act is trying to advance?
When you talk about 1325, I think a lot of times there's a lot of emphasis on participation. I think participation or integrating women into the forces is very important. But I think also another important aspect is the integration of a gender perspective. And a gender perspective is where you look at the different security needs of different people based on norms and roles in societies, access to resources, and different power imbalances. So starting within the U.S., we've had a combat integration initiative, starting with our own forces, where we've opened up all our specialties to women who are in the military, so that we have increased participation in that way. And also, we've done a lot of work extensively through our regional combatant commands, working with our partners to try to increase the participation of women in the military that way. For example, I was stationed a few years ago at Africa Command. And Africa Command, we had an initiative with countries like Botswana and Namibia, who were encountering problems in increasing the numbers of their women. And so we work with them. They had some women in the officer ranks, particularly in Botswana, but then they wanted to increase the ranks of women within their non-commissioned officer ranks. So we work with them, engage with them in trying to increase their numbers, and had some sessions where US Army Africa actually took a team out to Botswana and to Namibia to engage with them, to talk to them about the challenges that women faced in the military and how they might increase their not only their recruitment efforts, but their retainment efforts also for women. Because at a certain point, even the US military, sometimes priorities are shifted for women due to motherhood and other issues. And so it make it a little difficult to obtain them in the military. So those are some of the ways within the military that I can see the Combat Integration Initiative, the working with other partners to increase their participation of women also.
I'll get you just to expand on that a little bit more. And what's the, so if you're thinking about the weight of emphasis between those types of measures and external facing ones, like how would you characterize the balance? So in part, my colleague Charlotte is putting together the material for this was noting that one of the recommendations from the Independent Review Commission on Sexual Violence in the U.S. military is to integrate sexual violence into DOD's WPS implementation plan. So how would you characterize that balance, and how different do you think DOD and the defense establishment is from the other components of the U.S. government we've been talking about?
Okay, I think that DOD, in terms of being a little different, I think we tend to be more visible, especially when we're on the ground, because we wear the uniform. Everybody's familiar with the military, even though you find that less than 1% of the U.S. Population actually is part of the military. So when we talk about balancing that, and you mentioned the commission on the sexual assault and how they thought, one of the recommendations was to include women, peace, and security efforts within there. I think it's great that they want to look at women, peace, and security in terms of not only protecting others externally from sexual violence, but the fact that we need to look within our own military and make sure that our soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen are secure as they go about protecting our nation. So I think that's important. But I think more importantly, that same study or commission, they actually made several key recommendations based on four line of efforts that they established. And I think those are equally as important. It's good, women, peace, and security. Yeah, they need to recognize there's a connection between external violence and internal violence, but they made several recommendations also, which I think would be more advantageous to trying to eliminate the problem of sexual assault and sexual violence within the military. First of all, this is line of effort one, where they talk about accountability, and they're going to establish a new office, a special prosecutor within the Office of the Secretary of Defense, which will have independent and trained investigators. And second, their line of effort is prevention. Of course, you want to make sure that leaders are equipped with prevention competencies, and they can go out and talk to their subordinates about the importance of prevention. Line of effort three was climate and culture. And this is where they talk about women, peace, and security, how you need to create a climate that's conducive to people being safe. And then the last line of effort, which was victim care and support, all part of this study. And women, peace, and security is a part of that. So yes, it's good that they identify that, yeah, sexual violence, we protect as a force, is our responsibility to prevent others outside of our country from sexual violence. And yes, we have a problem within our organization, and we need to also apply women, peace, and security principles in ensuring that our personnel are protected.
Stephanie, I'm going to come back to you and talk from the diplomatic aspect. What's the implementation of the agenda look like? And are the lessons that are already being learned and developed, recognized, captured, and how is that going?
I do think the implementation, you know, I worked on the second national action plan during the Obama administration in 2016. And then we see, you know, what's happened since the implementation of the act and moving forward. I think one thing that's really important, and we actually haven't mentioned it, but it's critical, is that really in terms of looking for, to move from counting, you know, who goes to programs to the impact, is that in this last go round of really looking at how to implement the act in the most effective way, for the first time, I think the Department of State, AID, DOD, Homeland Security, and the National Security Council have come together and try to develop a set of indicators or measurements that will try to get at impact. I think that's an iterative process. It's going to be refined and kind of, you know, we're going to be looking at that over time. But I think this is a really important step in terms of how we ensure that the act is, you know, is effective, that it actually does what it asks us to do, and that it's effective on the global scene. So I think the measurement aspect is not 100% new, but really it's a much more coordinated effort to try to measure the impact of that implementation across the agencies and in conjunction with the White House National Security Council. So I think that's important. I think another lesson learned is that we have to think about how to ensure that there are additional or sufficient resources to really fund the work done by the Women, Peace, and Security Act and agenda. And I say it that way because the act itself does not provide resources or funding, which is has been part of the criticism of the act moving through as it moved through the legislative process. At one point it did, and then that was taken out to ensure that the act could be passed and signed into law. So I think as the act and the agenda really more broadly are implemented, it's important to recognize that we have to have resources for these activities and for the people who will help us carry them out. I would say as a bit of self-criticism, one of the things that we said, or I said during the Obama administration when I was in government was often was that, oh, it doesn't really cost that much more money to do this gender analysis or have a gender advisor, when in fact it really does. So we need to be looking at how to adequately fund and resource the work through all the various appropriations and funds that are going to be put in place or are being advocated for in this new administration. So that's another thing. The last thing I'll say is, and I think this is maybe a uniquely American kind of thing, is that I think a lot of the work that we are doing or will be done on diversity, equity, and inclusion in the US government really is women, peace, and security, but we don't call it that. And we don't think of it that way. But in a lot of ways it is, because if we look at what the goals of women, peace, and security are, which is to encourage and broaden the participation of women in all the various decisions that get made, one of the ways you do that is ensure there's a diverse group of people at the table. Again, not all women think alike, but it certainly helps if you have a more diverse group of people at the decision-making table. We may not call that women, peace, and security at the Department of Commerce or Energy or Justice, but one could argue that it is. And so I think in some ways, you know, that's we don't always label things in the US the way other people do, which is both our strength and our weakness, I guess. But I think it's always important to point that out.
Thank you. Susan, from your perspective, implementation, what are your observations on how things have gone?
Well, I would like to commend all of the people who have been doing this work for the past 10 years. And it isn't just since the act was passed. A lot of people at USAID and other departments and agencies have been working on women, peace, and security even before we had our NAP. And regardless of what was happening politically at the top, continued to do the work day in and day out around the world to implement, if not a NAP or an act, they were really basing their work on the values and the pillars of women, peace, and security. So that's been great. I do think that USAID has thought more broadly, as I said before, about what security means. So it's not always a formal conflict that we're going in to work with people after that conflict has ended. It also talks about instability caused by political transition, countering violent extremism. Obviously, there is conflict often caused by climate change and the movements of people based on displacement of climate change. The other issue is gender-based violence. Gender-based violence, it's been having a broader lens because of COVID, right? It used to be something that was kind of on the side, but it was the silent pandemic during COVID that issues of gender-based violence really increased around the world. And I think similarly, gender-based violence, you know, it's not separate from women, peace, and security. There's sexual violence during conflict, but often women around the world are victims of sexual violence, whether they're in formal conflict or not. There was a horrible quote from a book a few years ago by Valerie Hudson when they were interviewing women in Guatemala. And they talked about, you know, the conflict that had been going on for decades versus not, you know, what's changed. And she said, the difference for me between war and peace is whether I know the man that's raping me or not. I mean, that is horrific. But the levels of violence based on gender around the world can't be separated from women, peace, and security. We need to be dealing with it, whether it's in peacetime or because of conflict or because of these other issues, whether it's extremism or climate change. And we have to deal with them in a systemic way to help prevent them. And then after they occur, to really respond to the needs, the psychosocial, mental, physical needs of those who've been traumatized by it.
Thank you. And so, Carolyn, to come back to you, implementation in the defense sphere, I guess, how would you characterize the last few years?
Mm-hmm. As far as DOD, I would say that a lot of work has been done, some improvements by some really dedicated individuals, both women and men. In the recent report that was submitted to the White House, it listed numerous accomplishments in 2020. Of course, the Secretary of Defense approved the DOD Strategic Framework and International Plan, or SFIP, in support of Women, Peace, and Security, the Women, Peace, and Security Act. 8 of the 11 combatant commands actually employed a full-time gender advisor, or GENAD, and that's important for seeing that for oversight of the entire program. They've also appointed and developed a network for what they call gender focal points. The gender focal points are down in the units and organizations, and they coordinate with the GENAD. There's been additional training on these people on the GENADs to ensure that they have a proper understanding of how to implement the program. And then there's been money, of course, for the implementation activities to build partner capacity in support of Women, Peace, and Security. So when I look at progress, I think in terms of not only the lines of effort that we've established in the SFIP, but there are other things to look at too. In terms of leadership, is leadership actually supporting the Women, Peace, and Security principles? Is this gender inclusive leadership? A lot of times I've talked to senior leaders, and you find that because a lot of the, at least initially, a lot of the efforts have been bottom-driven by some dedicated individuals who kind of took the reins, that senior leadership often is not aware, as they should be, of all of the principles of Women, Peace, and Security and how to implement them. Another thing is institutionalization. I think that Women, Peace, and Security needs to be more ingrained into the policies and regulations that are used within the military institution. The thing about institutionalization is that these policies and plans and they stay with the organization. So as individuals leave, they're still there and they're a reference for continuing the program. Whereas the training needs to be at all levels, from the top to the bottom. And when you train an individual, it's different because then they take the knowledge with them, but that still needs to occur. A monitor and evaluation are very important to capture lessons learned of the things that were done well, things were not done well, and how to incorporate those into a plan that takes them to the future and they have a better plan. I also see that there are certain challenges, other challenges. Essentially, I think implementation of Women, Peace, and Security a lot of times has become women's work and has become feminized. There are male GENADs and there are males actively involved, but a lot of times it still reverts to women. Another issue is that there's still a confusion about the difference between gender and women sometimes. And so Women, Peace, and Security becomes gender, women's issues, whereas they should be gender issues for everyone. I spoke earlier about gender parity versus the adoption of a gender perspective, which is a mindset and how you view your work. And I'd like to see, we need to continue. You really need both to be effective. And I'd like to see that continue. We need to make sure that all of our citizens, if they want to participate in the military, that they have an equal opportunity to do that, increase the numbers. But on the other hand, in order to have a more transformative organization, I believe it's important to change culture and change mindsets. And that's where gender perspective comes in. how you look at military operations to make them more operationally effective in terms of the consideration of gender. And gender is a cross-cutting factor in a different type of missions that we're going to be called upon in the future operating environment, whether it's cyberspace threats, countering violent extremism, great power competition, and so on and so on. So those are the challenges that I see in the moving forward. I do see the plan moving forward. I remember the executive order that was signed by President Obama, 13595 in 2011. And I've seen a lot of changes since then, a lot of positive changes, but I think in those areas, there's still a lot more work to be done.
If I could just ask you to push on one thing. So you mentioned that not all the combatant commands yet even have a gender advisor. Is that a question of the resourcing? Is it a question of trying to find people? And for the ones that do, just to sort of speak to the institutionalization piece, are those dedicated billets or is that sort of a commander's discretion? I mean, so could you use that as an illustrative example maybe about how close to an actual institutionalization of these types of shift is the DOD and your armed services now?
So you're asking me why some have gender advisors and the other don't have gender advisors. I'm not quite sure how to answer that. Some of that has to be because of interest. I don't know. And some of them I'm noticing lately, they have they contract gender advisors. Southcom, I know, for example, they actually have a person who's active duty, who's a military, military officer, and that person handles it. So you're right. I think what you're pointing to is that there's inconsistency in how this is done, you know, civilian versus military, having one versus not having one, the different names that you call them. And I'm not sure why that is, whether it's become optional or whether it's been mandated that they do that, but I don't have the inside knowledge to say that. But I think you're right in your assessment that it is inconsistent and that maybe a better way of formalizing a program is to have it more consistent. And there's also a little bit of inconsistency in where these individuals are placed to. You know, sometimes I worked in the what we call J5 strategy plans and policies, and that's where we have our person. And then other organizations, you know, maybe they have that individual working at the command level. And so, there is some inconsistency in gender advisors and how they're operating and where they're operating. And I think that consistency would add to the effectiveness of the program.
Susan, Carolyn, I think painted a great picture about view about the full implementation of the agenda within defense and what some of the remaining challenges are. From your perspective, how would you characterize the how close to full implementation the agenda is? What's the distance between where we are now and mainstreaming within the U.S. government?
Well, I was nodding my head a lot because it seems very similar. There has been so much progress made, but I think the main, the inconsistency is what matters. It's actually coming from the top and the bottom. So it comes from DC, right? There's a policy, there's something that comes from the White House. People in the headquarters are trying to figure out how to implement it. At the same time, you know, folks on the ground are living this, right? Their lives, you know, for security for them means they can't send their kids to school or they don't know where their next meal is coming from. And so they're asking USAID and other agencies of the US government for help with these. So the question is how we meet them in the middle. And it has been in some places when there's a strong mission director where they actually appoint a full-time person working on gender and women, peace, and security, right? It can make all the difference in the world. There are other places where it has been inconsistently implemented. But the good thing is now that it's been around for a long time, right? People are more comfortable with the language. They have a more shared understanding about what this agenda means. And once it starts getting implemented in the US government across missions around the world, it's really hard to undo. And so I do think there has been consistent messaging from the top that it's important regardless of administration. But I do think the, you know, building the skills of not just people who have women, peace, and security in their title, but everyone across the agency has the basic knowledge of women, peace, and security, and at least know when it's good to bring in a specialist, bring in that gender advisor and that sort of thing. So building the general knowledge across the staff and the way that they can respond to requests both from the agency leadership as well as these requests from folks on the ground who want USAID support. But all of the, I just wrote down all the things she said. I do think that we still need to get beyond counting. I think the representation is getting better. And so we always want 50-50. I think that's important around the world, but then what does that mean? And so it's not just what happens at the peace table, but how do we measure the long-term impact? And someone asked in the chat, you know, what are some of those ways we can do it? And I think one is how long does the peace last, right? It's not just, it's what is the outcome of this peace process? And so some research that's been done over the years shows that when women play a significant role in peace processes, when gender is referenced, or women and girls, men and boys as human beings, not just institutions, are actually discussed in the peace process and what this means for everyday lives, that peace processes or the peace negotiated peace tends to last longer. So I do think we need to continue to gather that information. You know, we wouldn't expect anyone to do something just because it's the right thing to do. It is the right thing to do, but it's also the smart thing to do for long-term security around the world. And so that's why it matters for USAID as well as the Defense Department, because we all want greater security. Measuring how long it lasts is good, and we're coming up with other indicators that are going to be laid out in the coming months that will cross all of the agencies and will report to Congress.
And Stephanie, last thought from you in terms of how you see the implementation, how close are we to mainstreaming within the State Department as an example?
Well, I'm going to say this. I actually don't think this has been around a long time in bureaucratic, you know, in the bureaucratic world, right? This has really been a movement for women's equality that's obviously happened over time, but bureaucratically, we've sort of started this maybe 25 years ago with Beijing and kind of moved forward with the Beijing Conference on Women. Because I do think this comes out of that sense that we need to ensure that everybody, men and women, people of all ages, different ethnic groups, et cetera, are part of making decisions about the future of their countries. So I think in a way, that's a way to say, I'm not sure it's consistent. Of course it isn't. We've only really been at this bureaucratically for 20 to 25 years. And I think in a really intensive way, probably for 10 within the US government. Also at the same time, you know, there's this kind of parallel movement, which we haven't really touched on, which is to think about and implement a feminist foreign policy, or in Canada's case, I know a feminist development policy. And so I think all of this work that we're talking about is important, and all of it is really central to the idea that women and men, again, in a more intersectional way, need to be really part of the decisions that get made that affect their lives. And so I think it's inconsistent, yes. I do think we're at a point where we have a lot more leadership and political will to measure impact, and to really look at how we can move forward in a real-time way. The last thing I would say is that obviously two things. We need to ensure that we are imbuing in all the work we do across the agencies and between international and domestic in the US, a sense that we do a gender analysis of the impact of policies. There might not be a differential, but we don't know that until we really ask bureaucrats to do that and present that information to the policy decision makers at the top. And then lastly, I'd say I also would want to make sure we're not seeing women, peace, and security, you know, we're saying it has its silos, but not siloing it from the other work being done to increase women's participation across every sector of society, whether that's the economy or education, really looking at this as part of a movement that we can support within the US government and by civil society, again, to ensure that we are engaging and listening and really paying attention to the voices of people around the world, regardless of their gender, that, you know, age, ethnicity, all those things, so that the decisions that get made are the most reflective of what the needs are of the people on the ground.
Susan, please go ahead.
Just one point, because Stephanie and I have done a lot of work on women, peace, and security and the feminist foreign policy. And I would just like to say, I do think one big difference between the two is that with women, peace, and security, we're working within the structures that exist. And I think feminist foreign policy is wants a rebalancing, right? They want to focus on peace as a goal, where I think obviously women, peace, and security, peace is in the name, but I think feminist foreign policy is more forward-leaning in the fact that we actually want to, as I said, rebalance and really use the skills that we have in diplomacy and development so that we have to rely less on the Defense Department. I just wanted to make that point because I do think where there is a continuum, I think there is a difference between the two.
Carolyn, Susan, Stephanie, I want to
thank you so much for joining us today on Defense Deconstructed. Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Defense Deconstructed, part of the CGAI Podcast Network. If you like the show, please remember to rate us and leave a comment on your podcast app. And if you like our stuff, please feel free to check out our donation page at cgai.ca/support. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The podcast is brought to you by our team in Ottawa, and thanks go to our producers, Charlotte Duval-Antoine and Drew Phillips, for providing our music. I'm Dave Perry, and thanks for listening to this episode of Defense Deconstructed.